Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fly Fishing the High Country by John Gearock, narrated by David Colacci. Introduction to the Stackpole Books Edition. This little book was first published 20 years ago, in 1984, and I hadn't looked at it for a long time except in passing. Once a book finally comes out, you've been over the manuscript and the galleys so many times, you virtually have it memorized. So you put a copy in the bookshelf, move on to the next project, and more or less forget it. 10 or 15 years later, someone might quote to you from your own book, and the words don't sound familiar, but then they've read it a lot more recently than you have. So it was fun to go back and take a fresh look at the book with an eye to updating it where updating seemed necessary. I did make some changes, but not as many as I expected, and most of the revisions were in the chapter on tackle and flies, because that's where the biggest changes have taken place. For instance, I removed a longish section discussing the merits of graphite rods because it no longer applies. 20 years ago, there were still those of us who thought graphite rods might just be a passing fad. But apparently they've caught on. I also deleted most mentions of fiberglass rods, except to say that I miss them, which I do. The old glass rods are now marginal collector's items, and the few attempts to resurrect glass at high prices haven't gotten too far. For the most part, fiberglass rods are now a thing of the past. There was a slight revision in a passage on waders to allow for the fact that Gore-Tex waders have been invented. When the book was written, the only lightweight, stocking-foot waders available were made of latex. They worked okay at the time, but they were so cold you might as well have been wading wet, and they'd tear or puncture if you looked at them cross-eyed. I left the part about fly patterns as it was in the original, even though some of the flies will strike most listeners as antiques. I like that. And the fact is, they'll all still catch fish, including the Royal Coachman wetfly. My friend Ed Engel once said that the small streams and lakes in the high country were where all that stuff in the old fishing book still works. And it occurs to me that this might now qualify as one of those old books. And there were some other things. In the chapter on prospecting, I said that you can learn a lot about backcountry waters with a map and a telephone. That's still true, but now you'd have to add the many good regional guidebooks that have sprung up, as well as the Internet, which, for all practical purposes, didn't exist in 1984. An additional use of the Internet is a negative one. Any stream or lake that's mentioned on a dozen websites should probably be avoided because half the fishermen in the state have already pounded it. I've traveled a little more widely since then, and if I'd written this book more recently, since I've fished some remote cutthroat streams in Alberta and British Columbia where grizzly bears are a fact of life, I'd have probably added bear spray to the handful of things you should carry into the mountains. That and a loud whistle that you blow often, especially when you're alone. The main defense against grizzlies is simply to let them know you're there, so you don't surprise them. A whistle can also be used to attract a search party in the unlikely event that you need to be rescued. In the last chapter, I mentioned pecking away at the book on a typewriter in a cabin on the Frying Pan River. I left the typewriter in for reasons of nostalgia. I also left in the one or two mentions of whiskey and cold beer for the same reason. I've since quit drinking, but I have nothing against it, and I remember it fondly. But as far as I can see, all the rest still applies. Streams, lakes, and beaver ponds haven't changed, neither has trout behavior, and fly fishers are still mostly a bunch of closet romantics. Or at least I hope so. I do have to say that some of the more or less undisturbed places I fished in the local mountains 20 years ago have now been discovered. One place especially has turned from a rough trailhead into a fee area, where on many summer days it's all you can do to find a place to park. This place is officially a wilderness area, but entrance fees and parking problems tell me that the government and I have vastly different definitions of wilderness, Not that that's a surprise. Needless to say, the fishing there isn't what it used to be. I attribute things like that to the population explosion in the Mountain West, as well as the growth in popularity of fly fishing. But I've been told that this book, which, after all, stayed in print for 19 years, may have had something to do with attracting more fly fishers to the high country. That's something you eventually learn as a fishing writer. There's always the danger that people will actually read your books. But luckily, mob scenes are the exception, even though they're annoying when they happen in your backyard. In fact, there are still lots of little-known, underfished lakes and streams in the western mountains where you can find good fishing and solitude, and where all the old stuff still works. John Gearock, Lyons, Colorado, 2004. Introduction. All fly fishermen have their practical, even scientific side, but deep down most of us are romantic and nostalgic. We tend to want things to stay the way they've always been, and I think it's that part of the sport that draws us into the high country. Conditions in the mountains can be fickle and changeable, but there's also a permanence that is both fascinating and comforting. The mountains, any mountains, can make you pay for your fishing with time, shoe leather, exertion, and even disappointment. But they usually give back more than they take in terms of solitude and a sense of adventure that you just won't find on more civilized waters. High country waters cannot, of course, be lumped together under a single heading. Some are overpopulated with brook trout and produce only small fish. Some are rich in food organisms, and many others are sparse. You may find cutthroats, brook trout, goldens, rainbows, grayling, or an interesting mix of two or more species. Sometimes they'll be maddeningly difficult to catch, and sometimes they'll be idiotically easy. And those two extremes can be encountered on a single piece of water in just one day. In many cases, a healthy high country lake, stream, or beaver pond will yield fish no longer than 10 or 12 inches. Sometimes not even that big. But in many cases, the big fish are there. Sometimes that's because the habitat is unusually rich, and sometimes it's in spite of the fact that it's very harsh. How big is big? In my experience, fish in the 14 or 15-inch class are excellent in most high country waters, but they do get bigger. My friend Keith Bilby, a crack alpine lake fisherman whose brains I've picked often over the years, has taken brook trout, cutthroats, and goldens in the 5- and 6-pound class from high mountain lakes. If trout like that don't excite you, please write to me in care of the publisher and tell me where you fish. I'll hasten to point out that trout like that are exceptional, and catching them is almost always the result of considerable skill and knowledge, and more than a little hard work. Still, such fish are up there, and they can be caught. That fact alone can make a range of mountains look even more beautiful than it already is. This book will not give you detailed directions to specific waters, and, though the selfish reasons for that are obvious, they're not the only ones. Some of the spots I know of were found through my own hard work and research, but others were the result of tips given to me by other hard-working fishermen. And if the sport has one cardinal rule, it's that one shall not break a confidence. Also, many alpine fisheries are very delicate and just can't stand up to much fishing pressure. I've seen more than one spot get fished out in a single short season once the word got out, and once a spot is ruined, it comes back slowly, if at all. In fact, at least one major American fishing magazine asks potential contributors not to hotspot waters that might be harmed by the increased pressure an article might generate. Bravo! Of course, few of us can find it in our hearts to keep a great spot entirely to ourselves. But keep in mind that everyone you tell will probably tell someone else, and so on. Finally, although I've fished the high country for quite a few years now, and try to discover one or two new spots every season, I still know of only a handful of good high country trout waters in the Mountain West. This book is designed to teach you how to locate the best waters for yourself, in whatever mountain country you're fishing, and once they're found, how to fish them to the best advantage. As I look over this manuscript, I see that I've included a lot of words like sometimes, often, and usually, and statements like when conditions permit. That's because nothing is always true, especially when you're talking about high country trout fishing, and because every lake, pond, and stream on every particular day presents a unique problem. Dumb luck aside, I think the solutions to fishing problems are best found in a solid understanding of the situation at hand, not in step-by-step directions in a fishing book. The tactics, techniques, and fly patterns discussed here have all worked, but they should be considered as a good starting point rather than as the final word on the subject. A willingness to experiment and to deal with unusual or even weird conditions is the mark of a good fly fisherman. The best fishermen I know try not to make the same mistakes over and over again. Instead, they always strive to make new and interesting mistakes, and to remember what they learned from them. The High Lakes. I shudder to think of all the big trout I've spooked out of the shallows of alpine lakes by just charging up to the bank or into the water, eager to fish, and elated at having the heavy pack off my back and the long walk over. I can close my eyes and picture their long, dark shapes darting for deeper water, never to be seen again. I've gotten better about that in recent years, but I still do it, especially on lakes that I think I know well. Now, when I top the last ridge or round the last bend in the trail, I tell myself, okay, just relax and watch. Wading in and starting to fish too soon is the most common mistake fishermen make on high country lakes, or any other trout water for that matter. There are naturally times when you'll want to slog out up to your armpits and work the deep water, but that usually is the last thing you should try, not the first. Let's say you've just arrived at an alpine or high country lake. It doesn't matter if you've fished it many times before or if this is the first time. Step one is to deposit the pack well back from the bank and from a good distance survey the water. It's difficult to describe the typical high country lake because they are all unique. But for the purposes of illustration, let's say this one is fairly small, no more than a few acres, has a rocky bottom, a relatively shallow shelf running at least part of the way around the lake, and a deeper hole more or less in the middle. It may also have a stream inlet and an outlet where the stream gathers itself together and continues downhill. There may or may not be large exposed rocks, weed beds, deadfall trees, and other structures. The surface of the lake may be peppered with rises, always a welcome and beautiful sight, but let's say you can't tell just by looking at it where the fish are, or even if any are there at all. The first thing to do is scout the shallow water near the bank. I like to patrol the shoreline for a while, staying as far back as possible while still being able to see into the water, trying to spot cruising fish. The shallow water of a high lake, what's known as the littoral zone, is where most of the aquatic insects live and where most of the wind-blown terrestrial bugs are deposited. Therefore, it is logically the most likely place for fish to be feeding. You'll sometimes see single fish. The biggest ones are often solitary, but many high lake fish tend to cruise around in loose schools, making them easier to spot. Cutthroats, rainbows, and grayling are the most likely to school. Brookies almost never. How much of an area a pod of cruising fish will cover depends on any number of variables, not the least of which I like to think of as their current mood. But if insects are concentrated in a certain area, a hatch of caddisflies, a weed bed full of freshwater shrimp, or a fall of flying ants, for instance, the most active fish will probably stay in a single bay or inlet. Sometimes they'll work erratically, milling around on a shelf for a while and then disappearing into deep water, only to turn up again in a few minutes, sometimes in the same place, sometimes in another. On rare occasions, I've seen loose schools of fish cruise all the way around a lake, taking as long as an hour and a half to make the circuit of a 10-acre body of water. I haven't seen this often enough to make a real judgment, but my guess is that it happens when very little food is in or on the water. This tactic of spotting fish in the shallows presupposes two things: clear, still water, and a good pair of polarized sunglasses to cut the glare. The way some polarized glasses are marketed these days makes them look like gadgets, but they're not. They're among the most valuable pieces of gear a lake fisherman can own. If the light is wrong or the wind has put a chop on the water, you can still spot fish, but it's a lot more difficult. Rises, boils, and wakes on the water will betray the presence of fish, but unless there are a lot of insects on top, cruising fish tend to rise only sporadically to the odd bug. You may also find that it's the smaller fish who rise freely to the surface while cruising in search of food, while the larger ones stay deep, looking for easier prey. Rises are always an encouraging sign, but don't get carried away and go right to the dry fly. That's an excellent way to catch a lot of small fish and no big ones. Also keep in mind that trout are well camouflaged when seen from above, and just because you don't spot them, even under ideal conditions, doesn't mean that they aren't there. One of those big trout that I remember spooking came from a shallow bay that I'd studied carefully for a good 20 minutes and then waded into after having decided there were no fish close to shore. The fish was about an 18-inch brookie, and he'd been there the whole time. He was holding in about a foot and a half of water, and I almost stepped on him. I also never saw him again. Apparently, he'd just been sitting there, and that was the main problem. When you spot a trout, you see a little movement rather than a whole fish. Once you've seen the first one, others will often materialize in the same area. The point here is, always work the shallow water first, no matter how sterile it looks or how tempting the dark water over the drop-off looks. If conditions permit, that is, if you're not up against a stand of trees or a rock cliff, start casting from a position well back from the bank and work your way out. If you were right and no fish were there, you'll only waste 10 or 15 minutes. If you were wrong, you may be greeted by the wonderful sight of a trout materializing out of the shadows on the bottom, heading for your fly. That only needs to happen a time or two before the lesson is learned. Of course, the first cast may spook fish that you didn't see, and you'll be greeted with the not-so-wonderful sight of trout fleeing in terror. That's when the wise fisherman laughs at himself and learns the lesson anyway. Trout in shallow water are naturally spooky, and great caution is required when casting to them under these conditions. A trout is chased by all kinds of predators from the day he hatches, even before, for that matter, and even when he's grown to a size where his only enemies are ospreys and man, he retains that legendary shyness that has made him such a classy game fish. These fish seem especially attuned to attack from above, and that's how your fly line landing on the water will be perceived. Sometimes just the shadow of your line will do. Think of it this way. A trout follows a single rule when there's any undue disturbance on the surface of shallow water. Hide. Fly tackle has improved considerably since 1676, when Charles Cotton advised anglers to fish fine and far off, but no one has ever improved on that statement. When working the shallows of a high country lake, stay as far from the fish as your casting ability allows, and fish a long, fine leader. Under the most difficult conditions, very spooky fish in very clear, still water, the ideal situation would be for the fisherman to be well back from the bank, throwing a cast where the line lands on the ground and only the leader strikes the water. If what's behind you on shore doesn't allow for this, You might want to get into the water a little way down the bank and cast parallel to shore, but make sure that you're not wading into a pod of fish in that spot. In other words, where you're casting from can be just as important as where you're casting to. That's an extreme case, but if you fish the high lakes often enough, you'll sooner or later come on just a situation. The other extreme, one you'll also probably come upon sooner or later, is where the fish don't seem to care about you, your line, or anything else, and you'll be getting strikes almost at your feet. This kind of situation is most likely to happen with brook trout, little ones at that, sometimes with cutthroats, rainbows, or grayling, and seldom, one might even say never, with goldens. 9 times out of 10, you'll find yourself somewhere in between. In the still, shallow waters of a high country lake, I'll usually fish a leader that's no shorter than 9 or 10 feet, with a tippet no heavier than 5X. Sometimes I'll go as light as 7X, although a friend has suggested that you don't need to go that light. He may be right. The difference in diameter between a 5X and a 7X is only about 0.002 of an inch, while the difference in breaking strength is significant. Somewhere between 1 and 2 pounds of test. It's a good argument, but I've been in too many spots where stepping down a leader size seemed to be the key to success, so I still do it. I also seem to do better if I use smaller flies in these situations, unless I'm trying to match a specific bug that I think the fish are feeding on. As I mentioned before, if there's a chop on the water, your chances of spotting fish are greatly decreased. But there's also an advantage to this situation. A little bit of a riffle will cover your cast better and allow you to get away with being a little closer and using a heavier tippet and larger fly. Fishing writers have long been fond of attributing specific personality traits to the different species of trout, but although there is definitely some merit to this approach, I believe the environment plays a very large part in determining how a trout will act. Many high country lakes are rather sparsely populated with food organisms when compared with, say, a Pennsylvania spring creek, and the growing season is typically short. This means that a fish has to be an aggressive and opportunistic feeder to be successful. It's true that golden trout, as a rule, tend to be the shyest of the high country fish, that brookies and grayling tend to be the most aggressive and the most open to suggestion, the most likely to race 4 feet to grab a royal coachman, for instance, and that the cuts and rainbows will usually fall somewhere in between. Still, I think it's fair to say that all of these fish, when they're found in the high mountain lakes, tend to be opportunistic rather than selective feeders. This is why so many of the good high lake fishermen I know do the majority of their business with nondescript wet fly or nymph patterns of the hare's ear or zug bug variety. Most of the high lake fish can be fooled into grabbing a size 12 hare's ear soft tackle, even if they happen to be feeding on something entirely different at the time, because it looks alive, and thus, good to eat. The wet fly has the further advantage of being down at the fish's level, assuming it's fished at the proper depth, so the fish doesn't have to expend a lot of energy to take it. The decision to rise to the surface seems to be a hard one for a trout to make, unless there's a lot of insect activity on top of the water. Still water nymph and wet fly tactics can vary greatly, and that's another advantage they have over dries. You can fish at a variety of depths and with various speeds and styles of retrieve, some combination of which will often do the trick. While working the shallows for cruising fish, the best results tend to come if you can drop the fly well ahead of the fish, let it sink down to slightly below the level at which the trout is moving, then start a slow retrieve right in front of the trout's nose. Even if he's never seen anything like it before, and if it's a zug bug, there's a good chance of that, he may well take it out of curiosity, and because it's just too easy. The take can be impressively casual. Naturally, the ideal conditions required for this tactic to work, excellent visibility, fish that don't veer off at the last minute, and so on, don't always come together on a regular basis. But some variation of this tactic is usually the most consistent way to take cruising fish in shallow water. Since trout and grayling often cruise around the shallows in apparently random patterns, you'll often find yourself having to drop the fly only a foot or so in front of them, and this is where I prefer a smaller fly that makes less of a splash when it hits the water. At times, the fish don't seem to mind a fly popping onto the surface. Sometimes they'll even be attracted by it, but it's usually fair to assume they won't like it very much, and you should try to cast as far ahead as possible. When the visibility is poor, you're reduced to using the same tactic blind. You won't know if you're casting to a spot where there are no fish at the moment or are dropping the fly right on top of them. Happily, the conditions that will most often limit visibility in shallow water, a breeze, a cloudy day, or a light spatter of rain, will tend to make the fish a bit less spooky. It sounds like it might even out, but in my book at least, it doesn't. I'll take clouds and wind over excellent visibility any time. The speed and style of your retrieve will have as much to do with your success as any other factor, including pattern. The answer may be a slow, crawling, hand-twist retrieve, a fast, swimming strip, or something in between. As a general rule, trout that are cruising lazily seem to be more interested in the slow crawl, while those that are darting around chasing bugs want a faster strip. The fly should act more or less like the trout, because the trout are probably acting like the real bugs. When in doubt, start off slowly and gently. You'll be less likely to spook the fish. If no fish are working the shallows, try at any stream inlet or outlet, anywhere there's a current. The inlet of a healthy stream will usually be pumping in a small but steady supply of aquatic bugs, and it's always possible there will be a full-blown hatch going on, in which case the insects will be concentrated on the area of the lake right at the inlet. If the bugs are just filtering in a few at a time, you may find only small fish working the inlet. But if there are good numbers of bugs, then the larger fish may well move in. Also, a little hatch that doesn't amount to much on the stream can really turn into something when the bugs start to collect at the lake inlet. A good strong outlet can serve almost the same purpose, collecting the floating insects from the surface of the lake and delivering them in a gentle current to the waiting fish. I got into an interesting situation like that a few years ago on a cutthroat lake. The only place fish were working was at the outlet, and only in a little 20-by-30-foot piece of water where the current really started to pick up. The water was glass smooth until the last second when it went over a little shoulder-high falls into the creek. My partner and I couldn't see a thing on the water, not even a speck, but the trout, maybe 20 fish altogether, were rising steadily. We could see the fish pretty clearly in the smooth water, and they were darting around some, not just holding in one spot. We took that to mean they were very interested in what was on the surface, but there weren't a lot of bugs, whatever they were. The fact that we could see absolutely nothing on the surface from a good vantage point under almost perfect conditions meant the bugs were either flush-floating, like a mayfly spinner, or very small, like midges, or both. It was a one-man spot, so we flipped a coin, and my friend took his turn. He also took a fish on the third cast with a size 18 black deer hair beetle. I don't carry that pattern, so when my turn came, I tried a size 18 spinner and took a fish. Between us, we took a dozen fish from that spot, resting it for a few minutes now and then, and we were successful with 5 different patterns. I don't think that's too unusual, and I've seen it a number of times. It's rare to find a concentration of a single kind of insect at an outlet. I almost always use a small, low-floating fly in a situation like that with the smooth, clear
sample complete. Ready to continue?